Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Thank you for listening in. It's good to have you with us. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, one of your hosts today, and with me is Susan Franson.
Greetings, and thanks for listening to Local Talk. Ursula likes to start the show with weather. So, Ursula, what do you have for us?
If your garden needs weeding, like mine does, the news is kind of good. There's going to be scattered showers and thunderstorms, which will remain possible, too likely, between now and Tuesday night. Daytime temperatures will remain in the mid-80s, and there'll be about a 30% chance of rain predicted for Wednesday. And then Thursday and Friday, it should be sunny again. There is a slight chance of rain on Saturday, but this coming Sunday should be sunny, with temperatures going up to 88. So the ground should stay soft for weeding in the garden this week for a while.
Today we will explore the gardens for the stomach and for the soul. First, we'll visit some community gardens, and later in the show, we will be visiting Gardens for the Soul, two of the churches that hold down street corners in downtown Ames, one of the old and one of the new.
Word on the street was that a new Greek Orthodox church has moved into the building at Kellogg and 7th Street that has been vacant. Susan and I went to investigate and learned that they're not exactly Greek Orthodox. They're Eastern Orthodox. How much do you know about the Orthodox churches? Stick around and you'll learn a few things maybe you didn't know. I certainly learned a few things when the priest sat down with us to record an interview about what the Orthodox church is and what they're doing in that building.
First, this being summer, we want to start with a real vegetable garden.
So if you stay on 7th Street and follow it to its eastern end, you'll end up in Eastwood Apartments, which is a complex of affordable housing situated in a serene spot next to the Ames Cemetery. Hearing that we have a community garden in that location and my not being very familiar with the Eastwood Housing Complex, I was curious. I called Shara Bradley, who heads up the garden at Eastwood Apartments, and she said that Saturday afternoon would be a good time to visit. So when I got there, I found her working in the garden surrounded by children. She explained that she plants and cares for the garden primarily with children.
A lot of the work is done by the kids. And I weed and water at least once a week, usually more. So every Thursday I'm in the garden, and whenever the kids look out their window and they see me, they usually come out. The garden is five or six raised beds located in the center of the property, so it's pretty visual. And I do put out flyers and let them know when it's been planted. We usually have a lot of kids that help with the planting season. They all love to plant, and they all love to harvest. Recent studies have shown that when kids help grow something, they're more likely to try and eat it.
And who gets the food from the garden?
Anyone who wants it. I've seen people come out their door and grab something and then go back inside because they needed that ingredient to cook with. As it's ready, some people do pick the tomatoes when they're green and do fried green tomatoes, but it is a community garden. Anyone and everyone is welcome to take produce from it.
Well, Ray was here before you, so I'm trying to dirt by the tomato plant, okay?
Yes, it's onions.
Do you want to try a chive?
Yeah, I do. I love chives.
Do it.
I'm eating.
Yeah. And then I got all the roots.
What are you doing in the garden?
Watering and planting. Watering is the funnest.
Akira, can you hand the water to Adum?
What do you do in the garden?
I plant food. Oh. I love carrots.
You like gardening?
Yeah.
What do you like about it? What's your favorite part?
Watering the plants.
What do you like to grow in the garden?
Carrots and tomatoes.
Yeah, why carrots and tomatoes?
Carrots are really crunchy and tomatoes are just fun to squeeze and eat.
So are you glad they have a garden here?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Why is it good to have a garden here at Eastwood?
So that if you can't go to the store that day, you can come to the garden and get some food.
We have a barbecue every year, and this Tuesday will be our annual barbecue. So we'll harvest some of the lettuce and use it on our hamburgers.
It's very pretty lettuce. It's really ready to go, huh?
Yeah, it is. It looks delicious. I try to do some recipes with the kids using stuff from the garden. Like, we always make pickles with the cucumbers, and we make ranch dip for a lot of the other vegetables. And we have been working with Suzanne Hendricks from the Food Science and Human Nutrition at Iowa State, and she is helping us get a recipe box installed on a post in the garden, which will function a lot like a little free library, where the recipe box will be full of recipes that utilize the produce grown in the garden, and residents or anyone else can come by, grab a recipe from it, or they can leave a recipe that they enjoy.
Those are some of the children that grow vegetables in a community garden for the people to use at Eastwood Apartments Affordable Housing Complex. Shara Bradley leads the project. She leads an after-school program and a summer recreation program and educational program for young people at the complex. Her official title is Resident Services Program Manager, and she works for Community Housing Initiatives.
Community Housing Initiatives, or CHI, is a statewide nonprofit organization for affordable housing in Iowa. They bought Eastwood Apartments in 2009 and offer it as subsidized housing in Ames.
I asked Shara to explain Eastwood Affordable Apartments and exactly what CHI is as the owner of these apartments.
Eastwood is a HUD Section 8 multifamily housing complex that is owned by Community Housing Initiatives, or CHI for short. CHI is a statewide affordable housing agency. We're a nonprofit, we're not a government agency, and we are statewide.
And where's your base?
Our home office is out of Spencer, but we also have offices all over the state. So we are very statewide. We have about 1,700 units across the state, and each property is different. Because what we tend to do is go into an area, do an assessment to see what kind of housing is needed, and then build that kind of a set, that type of housing. Sometimes the city will come to us and ask us to build certain types of properties. That happened with West Des Moines, where they have a need for independent senior living. So
sometimes you're invited to come for a specific type of project.
Yes, and that's how we acquired Eastwood, too, because HUD owned Eastwood. And then they saw...
HUD is...
The Housing and Urban Development. They used to own it. I'm not sure if they built it, but I know that we acquired Eastwood from HUD, and we decided to keep it on and subsidized rent now. And we renovated the property in 2009 and updated all the buildings. That's when we made the raised beds for the garden. And we updated all of the apartments. We put in new washers, dryers, dishwashers, and just made the property look a lot better. Before the renovations, all the buildings weren't very visually appealing.
And it sits on a green area of land at the east end of 7th Street?
It is at the end of a dead-end street, so it's kind of hidden. Not a lot of people know Eastwood is here, or have heard of it, because we're tucked away.
It's nice being next to the cemetery.
Yes, they are very quiet neighbors. We don't get many complaints, though. No necromancers or zombies popping out.
Now, are these low-income apartments?
Yes, they are subsidized housing. So I think that the guideline is that your rent cannot be more than 30% of your income. If you get a raise or get a new job and start making more, your rent will go up a little, but it'll eventually stop at market rate. So once you're in the property, once you're living here, you're not going to get kicked out for making too much money. It'll just, your rent will adjust to accommodate that, eventually stopping at market rate. If your income goes down, your rent will go down.
So the rent is in relation to your income?
Correct.
Is there an application process?
Yes. Mary is our on-site manager, and she is taking applications. There's usually applications outside the door of Building 450, and you just fill out the application and turn it into Mary. There is a waiting list, and people are being moved in. So it's just a matter of getting them ready for the new move-ins, and it will be full very soon. And there is currently about 55 kids that live here.
Wow, so it's a family
neighborhood. Yes, it's very family-oriented. Currently, Eastwood is our only property here in Ames, and we started the community garden just to put the fresh produce right outside the residence door. Mm-hmm. Since it is subsidized housing, we wanted them to have a healthy option just right there in front of them. People who are on assistance a lot of times something called a food desert happens, where they have a set amount of money for food every month, and unhealthy food is cheaper than healthy food. So produce is a lot more expensive than buying canned food. So even when someone is getting assistance, they go to the store and they're spending their money on pop and canned goods rather than fresh vegetables and juice. And poverty is everywhere. Ames is so rich and has the college and everything, so it's not as visible as other places. Mm-hmm. It's more hidden here.
This is Local Talk on KHOI, and we've been hearing from Shara Bradley, who conducts a community garden at Eastwood Apartments, as one way to address hunger. I learned that Story County has a hunger problem. The Iowa State Daily reported in 2014 that Story County is the hungriest county in Iowa, with 12,000 people reported to be food insecure, 2,500 of which are children. People tell me that this problem still persists.
Another garden in town is also designed to specifically address the problem of hunger by using urban space to grow local food. This is the garden known as Food at First Garden on the property of Trinity Church on Ontario Road. You visited that garden over the weekend as well, Ursula.
Hannah Dankbar and Carrie Schonout showed me the garden. They're graduate students at ISU Graduate Program of Sustainable Agriculture.
We do a lot of munching in the garden. I'm taking you to the strawberries right now. I would say they're right at the end of their season, so they're sweet and they're delicious and they're beautiful in the garden. I'll snap that one for you.
Thank you.
And then I'll snap this one for me.
Very sweet.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, your garden looks good.
Yeah, it's doing really well this year. Everything looks happy, and we have lots of weeds that also look happy.
Mm-hmm.
Raspberries are coming in. We have a large number of herbs. We try to grow a big diversity of basically anything you would find in a grocery store. We do potatoes, garlic, tomatoes and peppers and cucumbers, a lot of greens, carrots and beets, brassicas,
onions, radishes. We have asparagus earlier in the season. We have some things that you wouldn't find in the grocery store too. Like we'll have sorrel or lovage. So we have collard greens, which are a favorite of mine, and lots of other produce that'll come in throughout the season. Garlic scapes today, which we harvested, mm-hmm. and talked to people at the distribution about what they can cook with garlic scapes.
The fresh food program in this garden arranges for the food to be donated every week to people who are in need of the food. So Hannah, Carrie, and other volunteers pick the food from the garden every Saturday morning from 9 to 11 and then carry it around the corner into a room in the Trinity Church. And their Food at First, a local organization that gives food out to people who need food, distributes it to whoever comes to pick it up. When I went there, I saw a group of about 30 people sitting in chairs and waiting for the food. I asked Hannah to describe how this remarkable partnership model happens between the various organizations that make this possible.
So this is a coalition effort between three organizations, Food at First, Trinity Church, and Graduate Program of Sustainable Agriculture.
Yep. The Food at First Garden is coordinated by graduate students in Iowa State's Graduate Program for Sustainable Agriculture. I'm currently a master's student in community and regional planning and sustainable agriculture. So we partner with Food at First to run the garden. And then the garden is actually located at Trinity Reformed Christian Church on Ontario, 3626 Ontario.
In West Ames.
Yep. We have a 75 by 50 foot garden plot. We have a shed, a compost pile.
Is this enough to feed the people that show up?
This supplements. The bulk of food that's distributed at Food at First comes from retail grocers like Walmart or Aldi, Hy-Vee, as well as Iowa State University and restaurants in town. So this tries to supplement by adding some additional fruits and vegetables. And there are other local farmers and community gardens that donate to Food at First as well.
Story County has the highest rate of food insecurity in the state of Iowa.
And food insecurity, what does that mean?
That means that there are people who don't know where their next meal is coming from.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think that is?
There's a lot of reasons. Food is expensive. Sometimes it can be hard to get to if you don't have reliable transportation.
Like Hannah, I share a passion for addressing food security at a community level. I think that really we have a local capacity to do so much right here. I think that the garden is an excellent example of how certain green spaces in the community, like this large grassy lawn at a church, can be transformed into a place that provides abundant food for our community.
Do you like the work itself?
I love it. Just being hands-on outside and then getting to harvest and go be part of the distribution and meet members of the community who come to Food at First. I think that's really fulfilling.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Susan Franzen, one of your hosts for today. We're listening in on a visit that my co-host Ursula Rudenberg took last week to Food at First Garden on Ontario Road.
I was inspired to visit this and other community gardens that address food security, having heard an interview about the need for expanding the local food system to fight hunger with Ash Brexford, the local foods coordinator for Prairie Rivers of Iowa, a local citizen advocacy group. Kay Puttock interviewed this service organization as part of her regular series of community service appreciation.
Ash Brexford, the local foods coordinator for Prairie Rivers of Iowa. Welcome, Ash.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Okay, now, would you describe what your job is?
My job is kind of a new concept. Being a local food coordinator, I work in Story and Boone counties through a partnership between Prairie Rivers of Iowa and Story County Extension and Outreach. In my job, I kind of work in three different areas. I do community garden coordinating, and then I also do event planning and workshops that help promote the regional local food identity for Ames and for Story and Boone counties. And then I work with farmers just trying to figure out what needs to happen to expand the local food system in this area.
Now, one thing I notice about local foods, I know it's very fashionable to eat them, and I can see why, but they seem to cost more. At Wheatsfield, the same item, like zucchini I was looking at the other day, the local zucchini cost a lot more than the zucchini that wasn't local, which is hard to understand.
I kind of get where you're coming from, because it seems like, well, if it's shipped a shorter distance, it should cost less money. When you're purchasing local food, it's a lot of it has to do with your supporting a smaller business. So their costs to produce the product are going to be higher than somebody that's like mass producing zucchini in Mexico and then shipping it thousands of miles to come here to Iowa. So that's one aspect of why it is more expensive. Local food isn't always more expensive, but one thing to always keep in mind is when you're buying food from the grocery store, you're not really paying for the true cost of the food. You're not really paying for the environmental impacts that it took to raise that food. You don't see some of the costs, the socioeconomic costs.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And the environmental costs. Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So will the local foods hub help with this? I was talking to Penny Brown Huber the other day, who's getting a local foods hub organized. Will that help with the sort of background costs a bit?
Yeah, definitely. So one of the things that Penny and I are trying to do is figure out ways that we can start getting more larger farms producing vegetables at a wholesale scale. So then that will bring the price down and the food hub would be doing more of the actual distribution of the food. And so it would be less on the farmer. So then the cost to the farmer would be less.
Centralized distribution.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And there's food hubs across the state of Iowa. This has been going on for, 10, 15 years. These kind of food hub concepts have been popping up. But with more demand for local food in grocery stores and more people going to farmers markets, there's, even more demand for a centralized distribution for central Iowa or across the state of Iowa. There's food hubs that work in multiple states, like Farm Table Delivery, for example, works in Iowa and Nebraska, delivering food from Lincoln to the eastern edge of the state.
Okay. Now, I believe you're excited about an event that's coming up in September to do with local foods.
Yes. So I'm planning a 43-mile bike ride that's going to start at Jackson Ames. It's called the Local Food Cycle, and we're expecting between 100 and 150 riders to participate. This will be the third year that we're doing the event, and riders will stop about every 5 to 8 miles. We're going to Boone, and we're visiting 3 farms in Boone, a greenhouse, more of an urban, rural vegetable farm, and then a conventional farm that's doing some interesting conservation practices. And then we'll be going to Boone Valley Brewing Company as well and having some beer and some pretzels from Salt and Pretzel here in Ames. And then from there, we're going to head over to Ledges and have some popcorn and learn a little bit about natural resources. Then we're going to stop at a grass-fed beef farm in Madrid before coming back and having our party at Westtown Pub in Ames with a band from Des Moines called Ruthless Ruth.
Now, you mentioned the beer and the popcorn and the pretzels. How about the other stops? Are you going to sample the wares there?
Yes. So we're working with the farms right now to figure out exactly what's going to be available around September. We're having a really hot summer this year, and so that's going to impact a little bit what's going to be available. But we know we'll have fresh tomatoes from Salama Greenhouse, probably some spinach and greens from them. And then we're working with another farm just to figure out what they think is going to be available that time of year. So there's going to be a salad. We're going to have pizza at the grass-fed beef ranch, and definitely will be not full-size meals at every stop. That would be quite a bit of food to eat over a 43-mile bike ride, but we'll have, you know, smaller portions for each stop, and then obviously have plenty of food if people want to eat a little bit more.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Okay, that sounds like a fun event. And the date of that is September the 18th.
Yep.
And they can find out more details on your website.
Yep, at prrcd.org. And we'll actually have the registration page up very soon at prrcd.org/bike.
Okay.
I'm doing a lot of work on community gardening in Ames and Boone and Nevada specifically. So if people are ever interested in how they can get more involved with community gardening in Iowa, I'm definitely a good person to reach out to for that.
So could you explain the concept of community gardening?
Yeah, so I'm working with about 10 different community gardens. So some of them are, you know, a school garden or a workplace garden. So it's a garden for the community that it exists within. But then I'm also working with the Madrid Community Garden, which has almost 30 plots, 4x4 or 4x8 raised beds that are rented out to people that live in the city of Madrid. This is, you know, sometimes people want to get into gardening. They want to be raising their own food, but they don't have a yard or
they don't have anything like that.
And so this is a way to bring people together in a space where they can, maybe more experienced gardeners can help less experienced gardeners and do some educational workshops. Like we're going to have a composting workshop there this fall. Yeah. So it's a good way to learn more about gardening, meet people in the community, raise your own food and flowers or whatever you're interested in.
Mm-hmm. Now, talking of composting, I've been doing it for years. My husband and I have been doing it for years. But I usually just put the weeds in the compost, and I don't know whether I don't get it hot enough, but I've got weenie compost.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it looks good when I spread it out on my flower beds, but the weeds come up.
Yeah, definitely.
So what am I doing wrong about that?
I'm not a composting expert, per se. And obviously, Iowa State Extension would have tons of resources for that. But I'm guessing, you know,
I turned it over more and got it hotter. It used to get very hot, and I used to be very gung-ho about it, and I had a thermometer and everything, but I think the problem now is I'm just a bit lazy about it.
Yeah, it sounds like the organic matter just isn't breaking down enough to kill the seeds off, so,
right.
Yeah.
And they say if you just let it get old enough, it will...
Yeah.
So the school gardens, to explain how that might work.
The school garden, the main one that I'm working with right now that is currently in existence is at Central Elementary School in Nevada, and that school garden school gardens are complicated because the time in which gardening happens, school is not in session. And so that's mostly run by the preschool teachers, and that's how most school gardens work. There's a group of teachers who decide that they really want to use these gardens for an educational purpose. So they planted the garden this spring, and then there's some people from United Way taking care of the garden during the summer months, and then they'll harvest some food with the preschoolers in the fall.
So the educational part is just that the kids come out and get to pick the peppers and tomatoes.
Well, school gardens are really great for learning all kinds of things. Obviously, science and math are very related to gardening, especially with like older kids. And I think that Central Elementary actually did work with maybe second and third graders when they were putting in the garden, you know, perimeter and things like that, measuring the garden beds and depth and all of those concepts. And then with like insects, I worked at a work day at Eastwood Apartments. They have a garden that they use for the children that live in that apartment. And we talked about earthworms when we were planting the garden. We read a book about earthworms. And then as we were planting, the kids were finding earthworms and getting excited about it because they had just learned about them. But also for other things like social studies and cultural awareness, talking about food through time and food through history. Obviously, with older kids, you could do home ec cooking and things like that. So really, gardens are pretty all-encompassing when it comes to education if you have good teachers who are able to make those connections for the kids.
Okay. And let's just remind people again about the bike ride coming up September the 18th.
Yep, September the 18th.
And they can look at that on the website, PRRCD, which stands for Prairie Rivers Resource.
RC&D, Resource and Conservation
Development. Yeah, I think it'll help. Well, I guess if they just Google Prairie Rivers, they'll find.
And then there will also be an event on our Facebook page. So if people are on Facebook, they can find us at Prairie Rivers of Iowa.
Well, thank you very much. I've been talking to Ash Brexford, who's the local foods coordinator for Prairie Rivers of Iowa.
Would you identify yourself?
I'm Myrna Cake Rice, organist here at First United Methodist Church in Ames.
And that is the first time I had played through that piece. It's a brand new book. There is a mistake in there. I'm sure you all hear it.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host today with Susan Franson, and that was the organ of the First United Methodist Church in downtown Ames, which is celebrating its 150th anniversary. As part of their celebration, they will be hosting a fashion show of bridal gowns throughout the past 150 years. We asked Pastor Fred, the First United Methodist Church pastor, about this show and about other ways that they're celebrating their auspicious anniversary.
We started our celebration last July 4th with a big kind of entry in the 4th of July parade to kick off a year. And every month we've been having some special recognitions. April 3rd, we held a huge celebration. We had our bishop here and other dignitaries. It was a grand celebration. And now, at the last Saturday in June, we're celebrating all of the weddings that have been held and performed here. And so we're having, starting at 2 o'clock, a bridal fashion show with dresses through the decades. And then we're going to have a regular old-fashioned wedding reception with cake and mints and coffee. And just to think about all of the couples that have made their commitment, that have shared their vows here in this congregation.
Some of these dresses are old?
I think the oldest dress is like 1880, 1890s.
Who's donating these dresses?
All the women of the church, the various women of the church, are donating dresses and their daughters' dresses.
So these are like family heirlooms.
Yes, they are. Uh-huh. So that'll be wonderful. And we have pictures. We have pictures that'll be up on the screens from all the different decades of weddings.
So a history of bridal gowns in Ames, Iowa.
It should be fun. It should be fun. Some of the really old dresses we're going to be displaying on mannequins because mm-hmm. they're so fragile. But other dresses from the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, we got some beautiful younger folks that are going to be modeling those for us.
So it's going to be like a fashion show?
It'll be kind of a fashion show. It'll be mm-hmm. a fun fashion show. And not only wedding dresses, but I hear we got some of those wonderful bridesmaids' dresses. So that should be kind of fun to see what were the bridesmaids wearing during those years.
Anybody getting married?
I just did a wedding today. We continue to do our fair share of weddings, as do all the churches here in this community.
Say again when the bridal fashion show is.
Next Saturday, June 25th, it starts at 2, so you'll want to get here early to get a nice seat in our sanctuary. And I think it'll probably be about an hour or so show with a reception following.
We asked Pastor Fred to give us some highlights of their church's history and to tell us who they are today.
The beginning of Ames First United Methodist Church was actually April 3rd, 1866, when a group of 52 persons came together.
And who were they?
Some of the earliest pioneers here of the Ames area. They came from the east as the expansion of our country. Settlers who found this beautiful land between two rivers of Iowa. The first group established a small community up north here, kind of where the federal disease labs are now. There was a structure built, and it was built sort of a schoolhouse church. And they established a preaching point in what was the Bloomington School. And it quickly grew, and they built another structure at the corner of Main and Kellogg. And that was kind of their second building. And I think they built that in about 1884. Mm-hmm. By that time, Ames was a growing town. And as they built the church up on Main Street, there was also land where the current building is located. And the trustees had the foresight of purchasing this land so that down the road they were able to construct a church here on this site. The church building that everybody sees and knows today, that was actually built in about 1907, 1908. In the early 1900s, there was a favorite preacher by the name of Andrew Shea who arrived and really grew this congregation to the point where they were willing and able to build this magnificent structure that we have. I understand that in the early years, this church was the site of graduation ceremonies, concerts, big lectures for what was to become Iowa State University.
So this is your 150th anniversary. Any particular highlights to be taken note of?
From the beginning, this church has tried to be a church that will open its doors and to address just the needs of this community. And then from the beginning, this church has really reached out to people in need. During World War I, Ames was a stop on the railroad with the troops that were traveling across the country. And this church fed those troops chicken dinners that people would throw together at just a whistle's notice to serve the troop trains.
They would eat in the church?
They would get off down at the station. They would come up here to the church. They would eat here. They would be, you know, refreshed and ready to get back on the train. Most likely they were headed to Des Moines, to Camp Dodge, or out to other locations.
So who made the food?
The women of the church. And I understand that, honestly, they had very little notice at times. There was some way of notifying people when the trains were coming. Everybody just kind of threw what they had together and brought it here to the church. And I know there was always chicken, and I'm not sure what else, and pie. There was always chicken and pie, and then whatever else they could throw together out of their cupboards to help feed the troops.
What does the First Methodist Church mean today in Ames?
I hope that this church is still considered a light here in the downtown, a place of welcome. Of course, Food at First began here 13, 14 years ago. We were an incubator for that. And the same thing with the free medical clinic. Throughout the year, we have a number of community groups that will come and utilize our building. Several musical concerts offered here because of the wonderful setting.
You have an extraordinary sanctuary.
We have a beautiful sanctuary and just excellent acoustics. What makes us United Methodists unique is that we're a grace-filled people, is foremost in all our theology and our understanding of what we are to be as church. Grace is that free gift of God's love given to us.
So it's unconditional love?
Unconditional love. And our goal is to share such unconditional love in this world.
This is Local Talk, and that was Pastor Fred of the First United Methodist Church in celebration of that church's 150th anniversary. Located on the corner of Kellogg and 6th, their building is a cornerstone for the historic downtown area of Ames, and as you heard, they are an institution that helped build this community. Some of the sound and music coming from the church building at 7th and Kellogg that is also a historic church building. And after being empty for about 4 years, it has now become the home of a brand new congregation in Ames. The church was originally built in 1925 for the Bethesda Lutheran congregation, which met there for 40 years, before moving to their present location on Northwestern in 1965. At that time, Ascension Lutheran Church was organized to continue a Lutheran presence in downtown Ames. The majority of the members, 167 of 205, transferred their membership from Bethesda to the new congregation. However, Ascension relocated to 2400 Bloomington Road in 2012, leaving the building at 7th and Kellogg with an uncertain future. However, the building has just been bought by a newly gathered group of Orthodox Christians who are making it their home and building the Holy Transfiguration Orthodox Church there.
The priest for the mission, it's still called a mission, is Father Marty Watt, and he stopped by KHOI together with a board member, Jeffrey Thompson, on last Sunday after the service to explain exactly who they are and what they're doing in the new building and to give me and I think many other people too a greater understanding of what the Orthodox Church really is. Father Martin Watt, you're the priest of the Orthodox Church.
Yes.
What is the formal name of the church?
Holy Transfiguration Orthodox Mission.
Okay.
We're part of the Orthodox Church in America and part of the Bulgarian Diocese of the Orthodox Church in America.
Word on the street is that there's a Greek Orthodox Church downtown.
Well, I would say, well, there's an Orthodox Church in town. We have a few people who are Greek in our congregation, but the Orthodox Church, a lot of people in North America in particular maybe don't know a lot about the Byzantine Empire, what succeeded the Roman Empire after it collapsed. Western Europe went into the Dark Ages. Eastern Europe still had an empire, still had a Byzantine Empire and a ruler that considered himself the legacy of Rome. Constantinople, which is modern-day Istanbul, was known in the church and is still known in the church as New Rome. And so to this day, the Orthodox Church is more of it's a collection of 14 or so independently organized groups that collectively form the Orthodox Church.
So does the Orthodox Church have its origins in the Byzantine Empire?
We would say that our roots go all the way back. We can trace the lines of succession all the way back to the apostles themselves, just like the Roman Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. We were all one church. Up until sometime, we started fracturing sometime around the middle of the 8th century, 8th or 9th century. The basic split occurred. There were five ancient patriarchates, or sort of the supreme, most honored churches, and that was in Rome, of course, was one. Constantinople, or New Rome. Jerusalem, the place where our Lord lived and suffered. And then Alexandria in Egypt and Antioch, which is in modern-day Syria.
Mm-hmm.
So those were the five great churches. And then sometime around the middle of the 8th century, the western part of the Roman Empire, after it sort of divested itself of the Eastern Empire, the Byzantine side, they spent several hundred years developing in their own way, and there was not much communication between the two, and it eventually resulted in a rupture, or what we would call a schism,
mm-hmm.
Between the Roman Catholics and the Orthodox. At that point, the Christian Church had not
divided itself
mm-hmm. into anything other than just the Church.
Mm-hmm.
So it was after that.
This schism happened when?
Well, it happened over the course of a couple of centuries. But
yeah.
If you put a date to it, we use a thumbnail date of 1054. At that point, mm-hmm. the differences between the Roman Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church, which I have to say were largely political, there wasn't a tremendous amount of disagreement over issues of faith.
What was the political issue?
The political issue was that the Romans were beginning to reassert their authority over the eastern part of the empire, and the east was also under siege from the Muslim influence in that part of the world. So they were looking to Rome for protection, which ended up coming in the form of the Crusades, which turned out to be not so good for the Orthodox. The one thing about Orthodox, we have a very long memory. And so in 1264, sometime around there, the middle of the 13th century, one of the Crusades, I think it was the Fifth Crusade, I can't remember.
It's one in 1204, actually.
1204, that's right. And but they ended up surrounding and laying siege to Constantinople, this city that they were ostensibly fellow Christians, and they sacked it. They destroyed the city. And that was the definite end of the schism process. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It started maybe in around 800 AD, went for maybe 400 years, and in the middle of that, there was an event in Constantinople where the papal legates came and excommunicated the Orthodox patriarch, and the Orthodox patriarch excommunicated the legates, and they all went their separate ways. Mm. The Roman Catholic Church went through a Dark Ages. They went through an Enlightenment. They went through a Reformation and a Counter-Reformation and all these other different historical things which have shaped the Roman Catholic Church to be what it is. Things that in the Orthodox Church in the East, we never experienced those things. Mm-hmm. While there was a very close synergy between the church and the state, it never got to the level that where the Roman Catholic pontiff became the de facto emperor and ruler.
Mm-hmm. Now the Roman Catholics have a pope who basically
correct.
Is the leader. Does the Orthodox Church have the equivalent of that?
That's an interesting question. No, we don't. In that way, we have each of the churches has a what's called a primate, who is the leader of that particular administrative group. But all of ours are considered the primates are the first among equals. It's a primacy not of authority, but a primacy of honor. When the Orthodox Church came to the U.S. through immigration. The first who immigrated were Russians who immigrated into what is now Alaska. It was called Russian Alaska at the time. It was before the U.S. purchase of Alaska. So there's been an Orthodox presence in that part of the world and in Alaska since the mid-1700s. The Russian church sent missionaries to this Russian land, and they evangelized the natives. And to this day, there's a significant Orthodox presence in Alaska and among the native population of Alaska in particular. Then that effort sort of spread down the West Coast. The first Orthodox Church in the continental U.S., what's now the continental U.S., was actually in San Francisco. Hmm. And then there was a migration that occurred in the late 1800s, early 1900s. People came in from what's known as the Carpathian Mountains of Eastern Europe, Western Asia, modern-day Ukraine, the old Austro-Hungarian Empire. Those people came to the U.S., and they brought their church with them. And they retained it as a sense of cultural identity. But then that created an environment where each of these different groups came from different parts of the world, and they each had their own home patriarch, their own home bishop. And so when it came time to ask for a priest, they would write to their bishop back home and they would send priests over. So consequently, we have a multitude of different allegiances and ethnic traditions that mm-hmm. brought the Orthodox Church to North America.
I'm speaking with Father Marty, the priest of the Holy Transfiguration Orthodox Mission. Also, Jeff Thompson's here, who's a board member. And Jeff, you're one of the people that helped bring the church to Ames or start this church. Father Marty, you were explaining how the Orthodox churches in the United States have diverse origins and haven't really come together yet in any sort of organized official fashion.
Right.
You were trained at some sort of seminary, if I understand, quite recently.
Yes. I'm a second career priest, so I spent 25 years in healthcare administration and finance. I'm trained as an accountant, first of all.
And this is your first mission as a priest in Ames?
Yes, mm-hmm. full time.
How's it going?
It's going well, absolutely. Okay. I wouldn't do anything else.
So, Jeff, you're a board member?
Yes.
And really, both of you are really starting this church. This is a startup. This is a mission, not a church yet.
Right.
It's a beginning of a church.
That's right. It's a beginning of a church.
So, Jeff, you grew up in Ames.
Oh, yes, I grew up in Ames, and I left to go to college. I lived in Chicago for about 10 years, and then I came back here about 4 years ago to get a PhD in statistics here.
And so how long have you been Orthodox?
I converted when I went to college, so it's been, I guess, about a dozen years, give or take.
Did you invite Father Marty here, or how did you get this started in Ames?
There's actually another family who was very instrumental in establishing the mission. They've moved to, I think they went to Purdue?
Yeah. West Lafayette.
Yeah, West Lafayette. There was a professor here who took another job at Purdue last year.
Last year, yeah.
Anyway, he had been trying for quite a while to get a mission started. He had, you know, zealously kept track of all of the Orthodox people in Ames. And, you know, at a certain point, you know, we had enough people that we could all work together and petition the bishop to say, hey, we have a lot of people here. We've been having services occasionally. We've been meeting. Perhaps you could send a priest or start a mission or something. And the bishop visited, and he said, oh, yeah, you have quite a bunch of people here, and we have a priest who might be willing to come. We got the ball rolling, and he's here now.
And the people who are the Orthodox people in Ames, are they from all sorts of different Orthodox traditions, or are they generally Russian Orthodox?
Oh, they're from all sorts of traditions. It's a melting pot.
It's a true melting pot here.
Yeah.
And are these generally people that are from other countries, or are they Americans who have their roots?
That's also, there's a very good mix there. There's a bunch of people who have, you know, Ames is itself a melting pot because of the university. And so, yeah, we have people from all over the world and also from all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of people who don't know who are Orthodox who still don't know we're here. In our congregation, at this point, we have somewhere around 45 or 50 people, and our Sunday attendance is somewhere around 25 or 30 typically.
So buying a building is a big step.
Yeah. I don't know any other way to say that. Yeah, it's a very big step.
Was it difficult to raise the money? I mean, 40 or 50 families, that's not enough to buy and renovate a building.
We were blessed to have a benefactor who basically wrote a mortgage that we could not refuse at an affordable price. And we put about probably $120,000
into the building
over the past year and a half.
Did it need a lot of renovation?
It did. Mostly just from being vacant, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, the building was in very good shape, but we had to do a few things to get it ready for the Orthodox traditional worship.
Mm-hmm.
We had to remove the altar. We had to remove the organ. Both of those things were very happy to say. The altar was donated to a church salvage company out of Atlanta, and they came and got it, and they'll repurpose it into a different church that can use it. The organ went to a Lutheran congregation, I think it was Lutheran, in southeast Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
And they came and got the organ, and we had to do some cosmetic stuff on the upstairs, but then we had to gut the whole basement, which had mold issues, and we had to replace a few of the furnaces and that kind of thing.
That was Father Marty Watt, who has become one of the newest arrivals in Ames. He's here with his wife and two children to help build an Orthodox church in Ames. It's called the Holy Transfiguration Orthodox Church, and they have purchased and renovated the historic church building at Kellogg and 7th Street. That is, the congregation has. If you're curious, the congregation does give a more in-depth information about who they are at amesorthodox.org.
You have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Your hosts today have been myself, Susan Franzen, and Ursula Rudenberg. Today's show was engineered by Jonah DeGeest. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. KHOI is streaming live on KHOI at www.localtalkfm.org. You can also listen to this show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. You can find today's show on our homepage as soon as our webmaster, Ron Carson, is able to post it.
Remember that you as a listener are the most important part of Local Talk. Your listening and participation as the audience is what makes it all possible and meaningful.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.